Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 20th, 2004. Today's session number is SCP-2004-01. The speaker for today is Peg Schultz Ackerson. And the lesson for today is Introduction to Spiritual Direction. Brief introduction to spiritual direction and the labyrinth. Let's listen in.
If others come, they can just join us.
Perfect.
So, I'd like to begin with prayer. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Gracious God, we give thanks for the beauty of this day, for the opportunity to be in this place. And we ask now that your Holy Spirit would be with us, that we might hear what you would have us hear in these opportunities for growth in our lives as people who want to walk deeply and meaningfully and responsive to the Spirit. Bless us now in these moments together. Amen. All right, we are gathered to talk about spiritual direction and then also the labyrinth. And so I'm going to try to divide this and give maybe a little more time to the labyrinth, since there's so much to that. And but I wanted to speak a little bit about spiritual direction and what that is. I've written up here a few different ways in which it's described: holy listening, spiritual friendship, soul friend, spiritual guide. Have you heard of other ways of describing it? There's a variety of terms and phrases. The one, holy listening, is a really nice one, and it comes from Margaret Gunther, who's an Episcopalian priest. And if you want a book on spiritual direction, this is really a very lovely one, and it's short and very readable. And she looks at it as an Episcopal priest. Much of the literature on spiritual direction comes from the Roman Catholic community, and very good and rich contributions there. And it's good also to have some other varieties. But Margaret Gunther's book, Holy Listening, is one I would recommend to you if you want to read something on the art of spiritual direction. This is an opportunity given that they're doing here now at Holden. They just started a few summers ago asking people who are trained in spiritual direction to come and spend a few weeks at a time, and to invite people to come and spend an hour with someone who's been trained in this. My training came through the Archdiocese of Los Angeles and was a three-year program in which you end up with a certificate. And there's all different kinds of programs around the country. But there is interesting things in understanding it. Spiritual direction is not like a little psychologist. It's a different thing, in that the focus in spiritual direction is to help us pay attention to the inner castle in our lives. As we would, you know, go into the world to explore different castles, there's also a castle within us that we would explore. Another way that Marjorie Thompson talks about spiritual direction is that it would be working rather than to gain information, to offer focuses on formation. And as you would go to a medical doctor, or to you would seek the help of an electrician, or that you would be involved in school and teaching efforts, would be to gain information and to learn facts with a goal in mind. Spiritual direction is more focused on formation, in paying attention to how might we grow from within to be all that we are called to be. It's about inviting change within us so that we can grow and change and expand and develop as human beings in deep ways. And what people have discovered over the years is that having someone listen with them often helps them do that better than if they just do it alone or don't talk with someone. Even Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about this in his book Life Together, where he talks about confession, that you can hear the word of absolution from your brother or sister better than if you just say it to yourself. That there's something about companionship. And what spiritual direction is, in I think in its core, is a companioning with attention to what are the spiritual questions that are probing inside of you that you might pay attention to better if you have someone sitting and listening with you. So it's very much a listening process. That's where the phrase holy listening is a good one. Direction fits into it in that hopefully the person who is sitting with you has some experience to help you consider the possibility of looking this way when you might not know about that, because the person who's been trained in spiritual direction has a lot of experience with a wide variety of ways that people and pilgrims throughout the ages have deepened in relationship to spiritual questions. One of the parts of my study in spiritual direction was to look at the mystics and to look at patristic spirituality and the desert fathers and mothers and those people that have given us rich resources of what they have done when they've met with this particular direction in their lives. And what do you do when you hit this kind of dark night or this kind of inner sadness or this kind of tearful experience or this kind of dryness in prayer when you pray and you are trying to be available but it just seems like you're getting nowhere? Well, a spiritual director who has training might have resources that they can bring to bear for you that will help you realize that you're not alone, for one thing, and that you stand in a great long tradition of people who have sought to be faithful to a deepened walk in life, and that we have this great store of riches of people from all over the world and throughout all the ages who can offer us little guidance and tidbits. So a spiritual director hopefully will have a lot of this in them to offer a person as they share together. One of the gifts of spiritual direction over the long term, when people, which is not what we do here at Holden necessarily, but if you have a spiritual director, often it's a relationship that can go on for years. Usually what happens is people meet for an hour once a month, and that you continue in that over time. Now, it's usually helpful to reflect after a while if this is a good match for you or not. Not all spiritual directors are the right match for the particular directee. But as you would discern that over time, and then that person can get to know you and walk with you in your journey and offer guidance and reflection together. One of the gifts that they offer here at Holden in offering this is that some people have never heard of this. How many of you has anyone here not ever heard of it?
No,
you heard of it.
No,
you had not heard of it. Some people have never heard. You haven't either, Roy. You hadn't either. So one of the things that Holden Village is doing is opening up this for people so that when they go home, they might learn about or know that this is something that they could tap into in their own communities. We have in the Holy Listening Room that we have here at the Village, which is in the hotel, it's in room 2, right up the stairs into the, you just turn this way when you walk up the stairs in the middle of the hotel, or in this end of the hotel. But we have resources that if people are wondering how we would find a spiritual director in your own community, I can help you with that, or other spiritual directors that would be at Holden over time could help you identify someone in your own community. And usually what people do is they'll meet with the person at once and kind of discern together whether or not this is a good relationship. And so that usually the first session is kind of a testing out as to whether you would want to develop and continue with that or not. The use of it here sometimes are only a one-time session, although I have, when I did it before, there are several people that were able to meet with me twice so we could follow through on things. And that could be the case here as well. But that part of the gift, if you haven't ever experienced it and doing it in this setting, is that you can just try it once and see what it might be for you. The time is the directee's choice in terms of what the person wants to talk about, needs to talk about. Often if the person can be just imagining what is it that is beginning to yearn in them, or what kind of questions do they have that are stirring that they could invite someone to walk with them on. And these kinds of things are what we do. There are no questions that are wrong questions, and there are no struggles that are too deep. People that are experienced in spiritual direction have heard such a great variety, you could never shock any of them in terms of the kinds of things that would want to be explored. But it's something that you just might consider in your own life. One of the components of it can be helping people learn new ways to pray that work with their personality type, with their lifestyle. We have such different lifestyles in terms of how busy people are. And to learn that prayer is something that if you're really busy, doesn't mean you don't have time to pray. You just may need some guidance as to how to pray in the midst of your busy life. There's also different dynamics as depends on how that people find as they grow older. Young people have certain kinds of questions, and as you get older, you have different kinds of questions. One of the things about spiritual direction is that I think it's something that really is available to us the whole length of our lives, that we don't outgrow the possibility of value in having someone sit with us in a wholly listening relationship. And the questions change. When we're young, they may be looking at identity questions. We may move into vocational questions. Vocational questions are often what are brought to spiritual direction by young adults. And then as people are older, they're dealing with questions of transition issues in relationships, as relationships change, and how that affects your own. Or even issues related to acceptance of physical changes and even death, as we look at the spiritual issues related to that. And so some of it is just an opportunity for that. It's not a substitute for going to church kind of a thing. It's not intended as that in any way, or that kind of thing. One of the things I like to do from my groundedness as a Lutheran pastor is to pay attention to the scriptures and to give people suggestions as what they might be reading in the scripture, how the scripture could be a partner with them in terms of their growth, and to identify with them how they can be doing that. Another possibility, which came with one who I was in conversation with even in the time I've been here, who wanted suggestions on things that he could be reading. And that's a good thing to ask of other people. What good resources, just for life in general, or theological things that you can read. So that's a little bit of a tidbit of a short summary of what happens in it. Some people come in and say, well, I've never done this before, I don't know what you do. And so to just share with you, to just not worry about it if you do some time of spiritual direction, that the spiritual guide will help you with that or will take care of you in it. And often it's just for you to pay attention to what you would like to talk about, what you would like to have someone help you clarify something on. It's not so much for them to tell you the answers as for them to help you listen to yourself. Often you know the answer deep within you, and sometimes you need someone to just help you hear what you know deep within. And so it's an opportunity to do that. So those are, I just wanted to give a brief little suggestion of that kind of experience. Are there any questions related to spiritual direction itself that are on your mind?
This isn't a question, but I've had spiritual directors over the years, and the one I'm working with now is a dance, a little bit therapist, I guess she has been at some points, but she's also a liturgical dancer. And so the form that ours takes is dance. Yeah. And it's just quite wonderful. I mean, it's like we'll talk a brief amount at the beginning, and then the rest of it is just all movement. And it's, you know, it's very revealing and very wonderful for me. And so I just offered that just to say that there are various ways of doing spiritual direction. In addition to the sitting down talking, there's other sounds also.
Right. Absolutely. And when we get to the labyrinth, that's another way. It's another way in which spiritual direction can be done. But dance is wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Are there other ways that you have experience with? Of
a
particular dynamics.
I was going to maybe just more or less comment, although I know it's more of the spiritual realm. I see part of that in when you mentioned your body being our castle. One of the things that I more or less is my own body listening to my own body, and knowing how there's things that I feel my body changing, that I'm listening to my own body, and how my body is functioning, mm-hmm. whether it's well or not well, or things like that.
Absolutely, and there's so much in our bodies. Our bodies are very much connected to our spirit, our soul. They're all integrated. And so spiritual direction can very much be body listening in that sense, or inviting us to pay attention to our bodies. And that there could be a book written at some point. Someone wanted, maybe Janet will write it. But, you know, spiritual direction, but it could be dance as spiritual direction. Dr. Timothy Lull, the late president of Pacific Lutheran Seminary, used to talk about systematic theology as spiritual direction. And for him, that was what was important in terms of helping him, was a good systematic theology really became his spiritual direction. And biblical study can be spiritual direction for people. That is one of the things I think that has been spiritual direction in my life, has been biblical study. And that's how it connects to me with Lectio Divina, as I would sit with, and we wanted to talk a little bit about what Lectio Divina is as well, but as spiritual direction. That Lectio Divina is, Lectio means reading, Divina meaning divine, that it's divine reading. And that one would read the scriptures with a sense of this holy listening, that you're not reading it for the content necessarily as information, but rather for formation. So that it's sacred reading, spiritual reading, Lectio Divina, that would be a way of doing it, so that a biblical study itself can become that. And singing can become that. There are some people for whom singing is part of the spiritual direction, as a person with voice training is helping them do that, but working with their body and the words they're singing and the whole process of it. So there's so many ways that is the case, that it can involve various ways. There are people that do sandboxes with spiritual direction, where they'll use objects and have the person, as they do with some kinds of therapy, but they'll do it with a sense of where is God leading you in your life, and use objects in a sandbox. I don't know if any of you have ever done that kind of sandbox thing, but it is also another one that Matthew Fox, I don't know if any of you ever read any of him, but he would talk about art as meditation, And with art as meditation, it's also a kind of way of having spiritual guidance. I used to do this with my children when our boys were young. When they would come home from school, I would have a project that they would do related to art, that particularly with one of the sons who was more inclined for contemplative kind of practice, this thing worked for him better, that art itself can be used as a way to deepen one's spirituality. Gardening is another one, that gardening can become a way of relating to this, that if you go at it in a certain way. So it's a multifaceted kind of a thing. But it is something that is being lifted up more now, I'd say in the last 25 years, that we've been talking about how to resource each other, how to help each other, rather than, you know, your spiritual life is just your own private thing, and all you have to support you is to go to church on Sunday morning or Wednesday night maybe, but that there's nothing kind of more personal, at least within Protestant churches, where we can help each other. And there's been an encouragement over the recent years to take advantage of each other and in terms of helping each other grow and deepen so that we can walk a deeper path in life. Anything else on spiritual direction before we move into talking a little more about the labyrinth?
Is there a commitment to confidentiality in that relationship?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now you would, that would be assumed, you know, unless somehow you talked about, well, you know, we can talk about this with this person or that person, but without that kind of, the assumption is absolute confidentiality. And so in that sense, it's a very safe thing. It's as with going to a pastor, if you're going into a session with a pastor when they know this is a confidential conversation, it would be the same with a spiritual director. Now, I happen to be an ordained pastor, but many spiritual directors aren't. But they would still hold that sense of confidentiality. So that there's really a deep trustedness there. Often people have said that they don't know who else they could talk to about this particular thing. And because they don't want to talk to their own parish pastor about some things. Mm-hmm. You know, that so a spiritual director can become an opportunity of a really separate person from your general life. I don't normally offer or am not in a spiritual direction relationship with members of my own congregation. I am with members of other pastors' congregation, right, who asked me to do that for them, their members. And that's been my, because it's such an intimate thing. Mm-hmm. It's really like a soul friend, where you can really trust someone with your deepest kinds of questions that you wouldn't, you could maybe trust your spouse with these, but your spouse doesn't always understand them or have any experience to know how to help you with them. And your spouse often has other relationships with you that, you know, gets complicated if you're just depending on them. I mean, that's where it's an absolutely intimate relationship, but it's not complicated, because it's focused on this 1 hour, focused on what do we need to do in this hour to help you move. And then it's not complicated by all the other, having to keep your relationship going with each mm-hmm. other. Mm-hmm. You know, that person can just do this in this hour and then come back in the next month and do that again. Is that
uh-huh.
helpful? Any other questions or thoughts or input from your own? Well, if we could move over to the labyrinth, which is another kind of tool that can be used. How much, if we were to, by the raise of hands, if one is that you know nothing about the labyrinth at all, and 10 is you could, you know, lead a lecture on it, how many tens do we have? Do we have some real experienced people here? How about a 9? So we have a 9 or a 10. How about an 8? 7? Somewhere in there? All right. About a six?
Yeah.
All right, five, four, three, two, one. Do we have any ones? All right. A couple who don't know any. Okay, well, we'll kind of go for the ones who really don't know much at all. A labyrinth is not a maze. The first question comes out, well, is it like a maze? Well, it may look like a maze, but a maze, you know, has dead ends in it, has choices you have to make. A labyrinth is one pathway in and the same pathway out, and there's no dead ends, there's no wrong choices that you can make. It's just one pathway that goes in and out. It's also not magic. Some people have thought, well, it's this magic thing that's going to be scary, and you know, all the things around the word labyrinth. You've heard the word labyrinth probably in other settings. There's a game board called the labyrinth, which is really more of a maze. So there's the word is used in differing ways that I think has caused confusion around it for people. But when we use it in this kind of a setting or with the kind of labyrinth that they have here at the village, it's not a maze, and it's not magic, but it does have deep mystery in it. And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about. In the book that's most useful in terms of an overview is Lauren Artress's book, and they do have this in the village bookstore, so you can buy this if you want to. But it's written Walking a Sacred Path, Rediscovering the Labyrinth as a Spiritual Tool. And Lauren had spoken with someone early on when she started into this a number of years ago about if you could change the world in one way, what would that be, that one thing you would do to change the world? And the person she was talking to said that what he would do is change tourism into pilgrimage. Now, if we could just briefly list off, if you're going on a tour, what do you want to make sure you take with you?
A camera.
A camera.
What, money?
Money.
A guide.
A guide? All right. Yeah.
A map.
A map.
Clothes.
All right. Good shoes, right? Good walking shoes, like those. Yeah. So if you're going on a tour, you know, you want to do that because you're going to go to, as we talked about, explore the castles of the world. Well, if you're going on a pilgrimage, what do you want to do? What do you need to have with you if you're going to be a pilgrim, go on a pilgrimage? What's really important?
A mindset.
Oh, a mindset, okay. Yeah.
An open heart.
So the difference really is that a walking stick either way. Yeah, you need a walking stick either way. But the mindset difference is that in a pilgrimage, the essence is that you are going to explore that castle within, and not just to look at the castles around. And the possibility of the labyrinth opens that up. Now, what I'd like to talk about a little bit with the labyrinth is that some people think it's a New Age thing, and you know that it's something that we don't really want to get too deep in, because it's just a New Age kind of a thing. But it's really a very ancient thing. Labyrinths date back 4,000 years in many, many different cultures, and many different cultures have different shapes of them, different ways of using them. The Native American traditions have lots of different ways of using circular patterns, and there's deep roots of that. As we utilize labyrinths within the Christian tradition today, we know we can't and we don't say that the labyrinth is a Christian tool. It's a tool that Christians are rediscovering as a resource and a tool that they also can use. It predates Christianity by thousands of years, but Christians began using it when they discovered that it too could be a resource for them. The Christian use of the labyrinth became strongest in the Middle Ages, when the tradition was for people to take a pilgrimage to the Holy Lands. That would be just a part of your spiritual tradition, would be to take a pilgrimage to Jerusalem or wherever your tradition had its Holy Land. Well, during the Middle Ages, it was dangerous to travel because of the Crusades. It was also very expensive, and the poor people couldn't get there. So what the Catholic Church, during the Middle Ages, established 7 different pilgrimage cathedrals around Europe that people could pilgrimage to in their own area, rather than going all the way to the Holy Land. So they put these labyrinths on the floors of the cathedrals. And then you could go to that cathedral in your own hometown, if there was one, and walk the labyrinth with the sense that you were walking to Jerusalem. And so the flower, the petals in the middle of the labyrinth, was called then the New Jerusalem. So that then you would walk in with the sense you were going to the Holy Lands, and then you would return home, so that you would be taking the pilgrimage. So in many ways, it was a service to the poor that the church was offering, so that they too could participate in the tradition of taking pilgrimages. But it was also for safety for people. And so that's what they would do. They would walk in with that sense and walk out. Well, they used these labyrinths for quite a while. Now, if anyone has been to the Chartres Cathedral in France, has anyone been there? Any of you been there? Have you been there? Did you see the labyrinth on the floor?
No, I didn't. But when I went, I was not aware of the
labyrinth.
I did not have that awareness.
That's right. Well, many people didn't. In fact, the priest of the cathedral didn't even know it was there until Lauren and Alan Jones pointed it out to him that, you know, they had completely forgotten about it over all the years, but it is still on the floor in the Chartres Cathedral in France. So if you go there, you can see it. Although they do set the chairs up over it often. But now they're taking the chairs off and letting people walk it and having week-long events there that you can go to. But what happened was it was being used by people. They would go on pilgrimages by going into the center of the labyrinth and walking out again. But then the Enlightenment came around, that period in history where we were afraid of anything that we couldn't logically explain. And I'm sure the Native American people, as they would reflect on that time in history, would, you know, really, because they have such a depth of understanding that we need to not throw out everything that we can't logically explain. But that's what happened. Because you couldn't logically explain this thing. It was something that became frightening to people. And so it fell into disuse. They just stopped using it over time. People would discourage people, oh, don't do that, there's something mysterious about it. Or, you know, so it just wasn't used. So for hundreds of years, you know, they just weren't used. So they forgot about it in their own cathedral. But then gradually we came out of that period of the Enlightenment into, you know, understanding that the arts were valuable rather than throwing out all the arts in the church. You know, that was a time in history when we threw out all the arts. We didn't want to have that kind of thing. Today we're enriched again by all of that. And so we're working as well to open ourselves to these kinds of tools, like the labyrinth, which we don't completely understand. Even today, we don't completely understand it. But people over many, many years have found value in walking it. One of the dynamics of the labyrinth that I've found meaningful is understanding how it's made. It's made by what's called sacred geometry, which is, in essence, a process of division rather than multiplication. So if it's a process of division, it means that it starts as one and then is divided and divided and divided and divided, rather than it's multiplied so that you start with you know, by adding onto it. So it's a process of division. So a process of division means that it starts as one. And so there's this sense of wholeness about it, intrinsically in the pattern itself. And that's some of what is experienced in it. Those that have reflected on it deeply, there's a sense in which there's a balance in it. Even as you walk it, the one that we have here at the village is the 11th circuit labyrinth. It's similar to the pattern that's in the Chartres Cathedral. It's not exactly like it because it's bigger and it's outdoors here. But it's 11 circles, basically. But what you do is you walk in and you note that you're going one U-turn after the other. When I was first introduced to the labyrinth, it was a friend gave me a copy of this book, and I looked at it. It was Reg and I were on our way moving somewhere, and I took the book and added it to the box of books that were going to be piled away someday to be unpacked. And it wasn't until I read an article in the LA Times about it that I remembered the book and went back and read it. But it came for me at a time when Reg and I were making a kind of U-turn in our lives. And this book became kind of a metaphor for me in that it helped me walk through this U-turn that we were going through. And I remember at that time seeing a bumper sticker on the back of a car that said, if you find yourself going in the wrong direction, God allows U-turns. And the labyrinth is filled with U-turns. That's what it is, basically, one U-turn after the other. But some of the sacred geometry of that is that as you walk it, you're walking this way, and then you're turning and you're walking this way. And there's something of the doing of that over and over as you're going around that you balance yourself. That there's a sense of balance that happens, and they're finding that there's something in the pattern of itself that's healing for people, that's helpful to them. And we're finding that labyrinths are appearing in medical centers, in hospital settings, that they're using it more and more in those ways. They've also been used in prison settings. Lauren herself has developed a program where they take the canvas labyrinths, like one that I have, that you can take into a prison setting and set up and enable people to walk it. They found one of the unique communities that has benefited from it is the, when you, life goes too fast for you, the thing Nathan
ADD.
That ADD people have found there's something helpful in it for them. We used it at our vacation Bible school this year. We laid it out on the our parking lot and had the children walk it. And one of the little girls is in a wheelchair. She has cerebral palsy, and it was really watching her experience of doing this, someone just pushed her around it and let her go through these U-turns over and over. And it's children experience it differently than how adults might. And but they bring to it their own self. But the pattern itself is something to it in how it's made. Some of the ways that it's used as well, one of the churches in California, in Torrance, has a labyrinth that they put in the entryway of their church. They had a huge sanctuary back when there was some big industry there in that area. Well, you know, a lot of the population left and their church shrunk, so they didn't need these, you know, 6,000 or 600 chairs in there. So what they did is they cut it in half and have the chairs up at the front part of the sanctuary. The latter part of the sanctuary has a slate labyrinth in it that's the Chartres Cathedral pattern, and it's just beautiful. And the way they use it is they invite people to come to church early enough so that they can walk through the labyrinth on their way to worship. The other thing that Pastor Crumlin does there is he has his confirmation kids come to confirmation on Wednesday afternoon after school. But what they do is, on their way to confirmation, whenever they get there, they're to walk through the labyrinth before they go into confirmation. And what he has found is the children are very different in terms of his working with them when they meet together after they've spent this time walking through the labyrinth, then they come into confirmation. So it's been fun to hear the different stories of how people have used it. The one here, if you get the chance to walk it, it's humbly made, and that it's got stones out there, and you know the weeds are growing up in it. But it doesn't matter. It you can get there just fine. And I particularly like this one. It's one of my favorite ones because it is big. It's larger than most labyrinths that I've been on, and I really like that because it gives you this sense of spaciousness as you're walking it. And it follows the same pattern. You can't get lost in it. This one, I think, is even easier than some, because on some, when you're walking on it, because if there's other people with you, they'll be walking out when you're walking in. And so you have to step aside for each other. And when there's just a painted line there and you step aside, you can get a little confused as to, if you're not watching, as to which pattern, which line you are in. But on the one here at the village, you can't do that really, because the rocks are there. You're not going to necessarily do that. But you don't, it's not real common that people get in the wrong pathway. But even if you do that, and Lauren puts this in her book, that even if you end up going out when you thought you were going in, which you may do if you end up having stepped over into the other line. But if you go out when you thought you were going in, it also can become a metaphor in that life sometimes gives us an opportunity to start over again. And you may want to think about that. Okay, well, where in my life do I want to have a new fresh start, where I want to start all over again? And you can do that. So it's an okay thing to do. So that's a little bit about the history of the Christian use of it, a little bit about how it's made, and the different ways that it's being used. I'd like to talk a little bit about how you actually walk it. How many of you have actually walked the labyrinth? So most of you have. How many of you, are there some here who haven't ever walked one?
Not fully.
Not fully? Okay. All right. So it's quite simple. If Nikki, you would just go over there and then walk towards me. She's in the middle, and I'm on the outside. And she's going to be walking out, and I'm walking in. And so when we do that, we would just run into each other. And if you're on a narrow pathway, it's only about as wide as her feet are there. So then we would just run into each other. And so instead of doing that, you just walk by each other. And you don't talk to each other, because you're in your own process when you're in there. So you want to respect the other person's process. So you're not being impolite to not even look them in the eye. You don't have to look each other in the eye. You don't have to nod or anything else. Now, if she's walking in front of me.
Same direction.
Same direction in front of me. She's going really slow. Now, my natural way of walking that I would be comfortable with would be a little quicker than that. So all I need to do then is just gently walk right around her. And again, I'm not being impolite. I'm not, cutting in front of her. It's really okay to just walk around the person. You can also, there's little labyrinths in the little spaces in it, where you can stop if you want to. And some people like to go faster than others. So thank you. So that it's a very gracious pattern, and that You don't have to worry about, you know, what the other people are doing on it. You just do what you need to do. There's no right or wrong speed, no right or wrong thing you can do on it, nothing you can do wrong. So it's one of those gracious patterns to enjoy. A friend of mine was told, oh, you've got to go walk the labyrinth. It's the most powerful thing you're going to ever experience, you know. And she went out and walked it, and it was like, it just didn't, you know, do anything for her. And I would say, you know, it's like going to worship on, you know, some Sundays are more meaningful to you than others, maybe. That it's not necessarily going to be a life-changing experience, you know, the first time you walk it, or but that you bring yourself to it, and that it's, in essence, it's simply walking instead of sitting and praying. But it's also more to it in that there's this pattern that we have seen over time has meaning to it in the way it's balanced. So that instead of just walking around in circles like I do in my backyard because it's not large enough for a labyrinth that I have, and if we wanted to carve into our grass, we could do that, but we haven't done that yet. So I walk in circles often, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's something different about walking in this particular, or in a pattern like that. The sharp pattern, or the 11th circuit pattern, is not the only pattern. There are 8 circuit patterns. There's one that looks like a circle 8. There's one that looks more like a 3-leaf clover. I don't know if anyone, like Amelius, has seen one of those. Has anyone walked a different pattern shape? Other than the chart one? The chart is the most common in this country because that's when Lauren Artress really introduced it to this country. And that's the pattern she took that's in the Chart Cathedral in France. But there are many other patterns, and they're all fine, but they're just different. And they do the same thing. It's one pathway in and the same path out. Now, in the Chartres Cathedral pattern, there's 6 petals in the middle. And if you're interested in all the details of that, they're all in Lauren's book. But that one petal would be like mineral and animal and human and angel. And so there's different meanings given to the different parts of the flower. And the encouragement is that if you go into the middle, that's in the middle, if... Like when I was walking it a number of years ago, my mother was living with cancer, and I would be praying for her while I was walking into the labyrinth, and then I would stand in the one that was the human petal, and with a sense of lifting my mom up. And it's been very interesting to me that the way my mother has continued to be a part of the my work with the labyrinth, in that I have a canvas one, and so we encourage people to take their shoes off if they can, or if they don't need them to walk. And so I have a whole bag of checkerboard booties that my mother had knitted, and she didn't have any idea that I was, you know, collecting them from whoever had them who didn't use them. And I have them in my booty bag, and so I have them there for people to use. So my mom is with me then. She's no longer living, but I see all her, as they're walking with all her checkerboard booties out there. I get a kick out of that. But so I would use that human one often for my mom when I would go in there. Some of the ways people use the labyrinth is with music. Often I'll have a CD. I often would use Taizé music. I bought one of the CDs from the harpist the other night. I think his music would lend itself very well to a labyrinth walk, and other kinds of music. I've done it myself to live harp music, and when I was at a session led by Lauren Artress, and that was incredible. She mainly played hymns. So one hymn after the other on the harp as we're walking. And I've also seen people use dance with the labyrinth. And another way it's used, and Bishop Egertson, former bishop of our synod, when he was installing the one at, or dedicating the one at, in Torrance, led a Holy Communion service there. And the way that can be done, there's various ways, but is that you walk in and you receive the bread from the person standing in the middle, and then you walk out and receive the wine as you exit. Hmm. And, you know, that there's differing ways of using it. It can be used as a pattern or as a way of doing centering prayer. Now, I've been having some sciatic nerve problems recently. I don't know if any of you ever have any sciatic nerve problems. But sometimes it's uncomfortable to sit over a long period of time with that. And so I found walking and praying is helpful to me physically. And you can use the same kind of discipline that one does with contemplative prayer or with meditation while you're using the labyrinth. So sometimes what I'll do in the labyrinth is what I do in centering prayer. Now, centering prayer is Father Keating's particular kind of contemplative prayer in which you use a word that when your mind goes off onto, you know, what you ate for dinner or what you're going to do tomorrow night or whatever it is our minds always do, right? We go off onto all kinds of things. You simply when you're aware that your mind has gone down the road or down the leaf on the stream, you are mindful of a particular word that you've chosen. And my word is Jesus. It could be love, hope, you know, grace, any kind of word. But your word then is part of your reminder that you intentionally chose to come and be here now for this moment. And so, you know, let's be here, not down the river. You know, so you invite yourself back. And as you're walking the labyrinth, you can do the same thing, that as you're walking, your intention is to spend this 20 minutes available. And so as you're walking, you can continue, when you realize your mind has gone down somewhere else, continually invite yourself to come back, and so that you then use the pattern. The traditional way of walking it is that the entrance in is a time for letting go, just doing that all the way in, of letting go so that you can be centered basically by the time you're in the middle. And then that's a time of prayer or receiving or illumination in the sense. So the walk-in is a time of purgation, is what they would call it, or letting go, or and then allowing oneself to be filled up on the inside, and then as one goes out, to begin to re-engage with the world and enter back in. And you can use scripture with walking the labyrinth as well. Lectio Divina can work. One of the things that can be done as a group walks the labyrinth together is have a person read the scriptures one time and then have a bit of silence and have that read again and then a bit of silence and then read again, which is often the pattern of Lectio Divina, so that you would be hearing the scriptures several times. It's really meaningful for people to walk the labyrinth with other people often. Sometimes if there's too many people on the labyrinth, it can be distracting. But it's nice to have to be there with other people, although sometimes it's nice to walk it alone. One of the things about the labyrinth is that at once it's a corporate and an individual experience. As I was saying with Nikki, that we wouldn't talk to each other because each person is on their own journey as they're on the walk. But you are journeying together. So it is a corporate experience, even while it's also a private individual experience. one of the things that I like also about it is the sense, as in the scriptures, that if one member suffers, we all suffer together. If one member rejoices, we all rejoice together. That we are really all one. And that's what the geometry of the labyrinth says to us, that we really are all interconnected. And so what happens to one of us happens to all of us. And that I think Jesus came to teach us that as well, that we really are all one. We're all interconnected. And there's something in the labyrinth that knows that by the way it's made, by geometry, by division. And I think that's something that's a mystery that's beyond us, but Jesus knows us, knows that, and wants to teach us that. And it's in the Eucharist, and it's also present for us in this tool that you may want to try while you're here. But there's, it's an opportunity. So
there's the hand one in there.
Too. And there's also a hand one that I don't know where that is.
It's just in the reading room. It's in the reading room, and there are instructions over in the box.
Yeah. One of the initial reasons for making the hand one was for people who are blind, so that they can use the pattern. It's got a groove in it deep enough that you can really use it. But anybody can use the hand labyrinth, and I've enjoyed it myself. It's very centering. One mother told me that she went to pick up her child at school one day. He was supposed to meet her at, 3:30, and she's sitting there waiting and waiting, and she's getting more and more frustrated because she's got other things to do, and she just pulled the hand labyrinth out and sat there and did this, and she said she was such a different person by the time her child actually got there because she was doing this than otherwise. And so it calmed her and helped her with her own stress in that way. But do you have any questions?
Oh, I was
or comments?
A comment was the labyrinth I know is the one up here. And I've been up here a number of times. And, walking the labyrinth for me is centering myself is what I've done. During walking the labyrinth out there.
Good.
That's centering for me. Mm-hmm.
Good. Any questions that you have in the last few minutes that we have here? Yes.
I'm assuming that the canvas labyrinth that you have is something that you ordered, or maybe you created?
You can order it through gracecathedral.org, and they will make it for you. If you want to save $500, you can paint it yourself, but it costs $3,000, the canvas one, that they make, and don't paint. It's $3,500 if they paint it. So, but if anyone is going to do that, what I did in our synod is I wanted us to have one, and I knew the smaller churches could never buy one like that. So I got about 8 people interested in it with me, and we got a sponsor who would lend us the money to buy it, and then shared it within our synod, and I was the coordinator of it, so that the synod knew if someone wanted to use the labyrinth, they called my church office, and my secretary would keep a record of who wanted it when, but that was its home base in my office. And so then different churches could use it that way. And then at the beginning, we charged or asked them to give a donation, depending on the size of the congregation and what they could, between $25 and $100. And so over time, it was all paid for. And it's paid for now, so we don't ask anyone unless they would, we say if they'd like to make a donation, we would request at least a $25 donation. That's what we do. So that we can work towards getting another one. And we have now about $800 towards the second one. But that's how we did it, so that a variety of churches could use it. But what I did with these 8 people is we found a church that had a big enough space to lay it out, and we put music on, And we painted it, and it took 3 days to paint it. But it was a fun experience and very meaningful to do that. So I would recommend painting it yourself. If they pencil on the pattern, oh, that's the hard part.
So they've got that down.
The pattern is on there in pencil, and then you just paint it. So it's very easy. But you can, they can also, for $100, they can send you a kit on how to make it yourself.
You mentioned that it was 4,000 years old, kind of pre-Christian, pre-Chart, and so forth. What do you know, where did it come from initially?
When it says 4,000 years old, that the oldest known labyrinth is about 4,000 years old, with a sense of it, a pattern on the wall on the island of Crete. And it's this circular pattern. And then it appears in different cultures in different patterns. But they don't know really where it came from.
And do they know what they did with it, like in Crete?
No. And that was some of the unknownness about it all, that, you know, why it went into disuse, because it was too scary. They don't really know the real stuff about it. But the one on the wall on the island of Crete is, but they are, Reg and I were in Germany, or in Prague in July, and there was a labyrinth in Prague. There's one in Switzerland. You know, they're all over the world now. And someday I'll get to the Chartres Cathedral and make sure they get the chairs off the floor if they're not off when I get there. But you know, there are unknown things about, you know, how it sprung up in all these different places and different patterns and all.
I was going to ask the dimension of the.
Well, the one that Grace Cathedral. Grace Cathedral is the Cathedral Episcopal Church in San Francisco, up at the top of Knob Hill, and they will make them a couple of different sizes, but the one they usually recommend is the one that's 37 feet by 37 feet. And they recommend that one because really any smaller is hard to walk. Pathway is about, you know, that wide. And if you get any smaller than that, you know, it's difficult to walk on it. And especially if you're going to do something like a wheelchair on it, it becomes impossible. It's much smaller than the one out here. But they do make them smaller than that. But I wouldn't recommend them. The problem with 37 by 37 is it's pretty big. It wouldn't fit in this room. It's bigger than this room. Hmm. We can't use it at Messiah on the inside. Our church parish hall is, you know, often church parish halls are long and not wide enough. So I put ours in the parking lot, and it works just fine in the parking lot. But it doesn't fit in our backyard. I measured it out. It doesn't fit.
We've had that house in our village center, and it took up most of the center part of the room.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might want to mention SoCal West.
Yeah, the reason I put SoCal West here, so if you want to know where, one of the things Grace Cathedral through Veriditas, which is the name of the group that Lauren has founded really there at Grace Cathedral. One of the resources that they've made available is that they have asked anyone who has a labyrinth around the world to register it with them. Mm. My Canvas Labyrinth is registered on there. They've asked Canvas Labyrinths I don't know if the Villages is on there.
We should
do that, because they would be delighted to know that. But then you can look it up. So what you do is by city. So, you know, we're going to go to Seattle. Where can we find a labyrinth? So you put Seattle in, and they'll tell you where the closest labyrinth is. So I often get emails or phone calls, because my email is on there. We hear you have a labyrinth. When can we use it? You know, or when are you going to have it up so we can come walk it? Or where is there one? In near us, there's a labyrinth at the Forest Lawn in Glendale, California. And so, you know, people can go walk it there. But anyway, that's a resource that you would all want to know about. Just look up gracecathedral.org, put your city in, and find out where the closest one is to you. And we should do that, Janet. Get the Villages on there. That would be great. I also added SoCalSynod.org because I've written about a 5-6 page paper on the labyrinth. It's the one that the most of it is in the center of the village's labyrinth. That's all wet out there right now. It's got plastic around it. But if you walk to the center of the labyrinth, you'll see a 5-6 page paper. Most of that is there's some other pages in there as well, but most of that is a paper that I wrote. And if you want to get a copy of it, it's on SoCalSynod.org and just...
It says Labyrinth.
It says Labyrinth eventually. You can get to Labyrinth and it's on there. So it gives ideas about the histories on there, how to walk it, different ideas. So it's a resource for you. But it's nice to have it out there, Janet, whoever put it out there. In the plastic, so it's not completely, it's able to handle the rain.
I'm interested in who did the labyrinth here. When was it?
It was done in about 1998 or 99. Martin Wells, it was his dream to have it. He was a former director here. He and Tom Witt did the math and geometry. Mm-hmm. And then there were some other people here then that helped them with that.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I think it is very much a mathematical process. So if you have a mathematician, right, you know, in your congregation that wants to play with it, you can make them yourselves if you get, you know, the instructions to know how to do it. Some people have put them on in paint on their parking lots. At the first one they had at La Casa de Maria, a Catholic retreat center in Santa Barbara, California, they did by taking a trowel thing with flour, and they made it with flour with the idea that the birds would eat it eventually rather than it wasting anything. but that's how they put it on their grass. With flour on the grass. So.
Does someone here stay here all the time? And then there was one at New Year's Eve up on.
Yeah, well, we try to tromp that one out in the wintertime. It's a big job to keep it tromped out. Last year we lost it. Mm-hmm. So someone was here at the holiday time and created a smaller one up on the tailings up here, which was delightful. Mm-hmm. We used it on New Year's Eve with lanterns. The lanterns that are in the windows up in the dining hall and candles in them.
They did that. Yeah.
You walked it.
Oh, nice. Very creative. I mean, you can be very creative with it. You know, sometimes people put candles around the edges of them. I've strung little Christmas lights around the edge of it at one of the parking lots where I did it. And did it as a welcome to Advent. We did it on the first Sunday of Advent and had these little lights around it. Another way I'd like to use it, and we did it in our congregation that is a bilingual congregation, it's one of the things you can do bilingually because you're not talking to each other. And so we did that. We had people who could not talk the same language, but they could walk the labyrinth together. It might be a fun thing to do with the week when you have
probably in the coming up.
Yeah, you know, if you had a canvas one in the village center, you know, that people could actually do that together and not. But anyway, what I did that day, we did it on the Ascension, because we gave I did a sermon and then I had people walk, but I had a bowl by the entrance. So that as they entered in, I marked them with the cross and the water, reminded them of their baptism as they walked in. And so there's all kinds of rich ways that you can bring the theology and richness into it. So any other questions? Our time is up, but if there's any other questions. Thank you for listening and blessings to you on each of your spiritual journeys that you might grow and enjoy the gift of God in your life and as you're a fruitful vine for God in this world. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.